From KCRW, this is Greater LA. It's the show that connects you to the people and places of Southern California. Hi there, I'm Steve Chiotakis. On this day that thousands of Hollywood's film and TV writers are striking, we're going to do a flashback scene now. Cue the effects. Back in time to more than 15 years ago, 2007, that's the last time there was a writer's strike.
I'm Bill Whitaker in Los Angeles, where the writer's strike is in full swing. Tonight on the CBS Evening News with Katie Couric, I'll have a full report on the strike and how it might impact what you see on your TV and at the movie theater.
Last night, 12 News' Mike Miller showed you why writers are on strike. Tonight he joins us with a devastating impact on the economy and the workers caught in the
middle. The union is demanding more money for the writers from DVD sales and digital media.
We'd like to see everybody sit down and compromise and try and work it out.
You know, we're here at the base of the Die Hard building, so I guess the slogan of the day should be, yippee-ki-yay, motherfuckers.
It would turn into a 100-day stoppage that halted dozens of Hollywood productions, sending ripple effects throughout the industry. It paused work for many behind-the-scenes production workers. Now, as Writers Guild members hit the picket lines once again to demand things like higher pay, protections from new technology, and better working conditions, those so-called below-the-line workers are also bracing for a Hollywood intermission, and some are already feeling the sting. Melissa Way is a stunt driver and actor, and Matt Atzenhofer is a Hollywood set dresser. Thanks so much for coming on and talking with us today, and welcome to you both.
Thank you.
Thank you very much.
Matt, I'll start with you. You were in Los Angeles during the last Writers Guild strike in 2007, right? Tell us a bit about what you and other production workers went through back then.
I was fortunate enough to be working on a show. It was Fast and Furious 4. That when the strike happened, we just kept in pre-production. So I was very, very fortunate at that time, but many of my friends were less fortunate, and I find myself in that position today.
You find yourself in that position today. So what are you doing right now, and how is it going to affect you?
Well, what I'm doing is taking advantage of the time off. I'm going to see lots of doctors. I'm going to get physical therapy. I'm spending more time with my wife and my family and my garden and just trying to make the best out of it.
Are you thinking it could go as long, maybe longer than the last time? Do you have any thoughts on this?
Well, I don't have enough information. The thing that I think is going to make a big difference is if the Teamsters and IATSE decide not to cross the lines, because we were told to cross the lines the last time. And if we didn't, I don't think it would have lasted as long. And perhaps if we don't again this time, maybe it won't last as long. But honestly, I have absolutely no idea.
Melissa Way, is that similar to what you've been dealing with? What have you been told?
We've been told that everything is going to come to a screeching halt. And so I am going to use some of the time to advance my skills. I'm going to go back to school and get my CDL, my commercial driver's license, so that when we start production again, I'm going to be able to stunt big rigs and things like that. But yeah, even after this strike, there's two more. DGA and SAG are both going to the table after this. So we've been warned that this, while it's just WGA at the table now, it could be a longer period for us.
So you're talking, you know, Directors Guild and also the Screen Actors Guild, both also negotiating going forward. How has this affected you financially? I mean, I know we're only day one in the strike. What do you do? Counting pennies? I mean, how do you get through something like this? I'll ask you first, Melissa.
We have been a little slower anyway leading up to this. And so we have been really saving money and not splurging as much. And we've been told that by like our leaders that have been talking to us. And so I have been doing a lot of side gigs and things like that and saving money, knowing that this is coming.
Matt, did you get some warning? Obviously, it's been in the news that we knew that there was the possibility of this. Did that give you a head start on keeping things sort of, you know, in tow?
I wish I could say that. We moved just recently. Actually, I moved the week of the last week of the show I was on. So with that, coupled with the lack of work, obviously things are really, really tight, but we're just clamping down. I'm making more meals at home because we don't eat out. And we're just going to have to scrape by for a little bit. And when we come out of this, build those savings back up.
I mean, all things are not equal in all the realms. You know, I mean, you've got a lot of higher paid writers that are on strike. And I know that folks who work below the line and do so many other things in Hollywood are going to be affected financially. And I wonder if that bothers either one of you. You know, what's the general sentiment about it? You know, the fact that some folks don't have it as good, or maybe haven't been able to amass enough money to even survive a strike. Melissa?
It's hard because we know that this is for the betterment of our future in terms of securing those better deals. And we need to have people who aren't the bigger writers, who aren't the bigger players in Hollywood, we need to be taken seriously. And they need to be able to secure proper deals. But at the same time, we gotta work. We got to work. We just came off of COVID and we're starving. So if you're not a huge player in Hollywood, it's really hard to maintain a living here. So it's really mixed emotions for people who aren't making the big money, who are just trying to get by on the gigs that we can get.
Matt, do some folks feel like the writers might do better, get a better deal after the strike and after the negotiations, but then lower paid workers are, you know, they seem to be the ones who will suffer the worst consequences, right, from the strike and don't actually stand to gain much at all, including not working because of the strike?
Well, I think that's possibly true. However, when unions and guilds and workers unite and get something better from themselves, we see the evidence throughout the history of this country that when unions do better, even the non-union workers do better, but other unions do better. So we're going to hopefully build on what they gain, and then we will gain as well, because IATSE, we're another year and a half, 2 years from our contract. So we're starting.
Well, you were about to go on strike last year, right? Was it? I mean,
yes.
Was pretty close. Yeah,
it was pretty close. We voted for a strike authorization, and we obviously didn't. We got some gains, and now we have to build on that. It all has to build on each other. You know, it's not a one stop shop or a one time thing. I wish personally that we could all get our contract negotiation at the same time, but I believe before I got in 30 years ago, a bit before that, they kind of broke that up. At one point, everybody was negotiating around the same time, especially with the Teamsters, and they got us off. Now, I could be wrong about that, but I believe that's what happened. And if we were to be able to do it together, you know, at the same time, then we would be even more united, I think. Yes, this is going to hurt us, but I'm hopeful in the long run, it's going to help all of us.
In a best-case scenario, Melissa, what do you see in all of this, and what are your hopes and dreams?
I think something that is maybe kind of, it may be not new, but it is being taken more seriously, is that the unions are standing together and saying, hey, we really do need better working conditions. We really do need residuals from the streaming. The lower level writers, or even the, you know, mid-level writers, are really struggling just to make things work in LA right now. And with SAG standing next to them and the Teamsters standing next to them and everybody uniting together, I think that the motion picture folks are taking it more seriously. And I think that is really good. So I'm hoping that with everybody standing together, we might have some better outcomes and be taken more seriously.
Melissa Way, stunt driver, actor, Matt Atzenhofer, Hollywood set dresser. Thanks to you both for coming on and talking with us. Good luck to you.
Thank you so much.
Thank you very much.
Introducing the KCRW donation car, designed to be recycled. This first-of-its-kind vehicle will save you time, space, and hassle by disappearing. Enjoy the luxury and comfort of turning your underused car into a donation worth hundreds, even thousands of dollars. The KCRW donation car, already in your garage, driveway, or on cinder blocks outside your house. Act now at kcrw.com/cars.
More now of Greater LA from KCRW. I'm Steve Chiatakis, and efforts to combat the scourge of fentanyl in Orange County. Fentanyl, of course, is a synthetic opioid. It's used as a pain reliever and anesthetic, but it's also become a popular and cheap street drug with devastating consequences all across America. In 2021, some 71,000 people died from overdoses of fentanyl, and the numbers have only gotten worse. Orange County has seen its fair share, and civic leaders there are looking for ways to do something about it. LA Times columnist Gustavo Arellano is here with today's KCRW Orange County Line. Hey, Gustavo.
Hola, Steve.
There was a news conference last week, right, in Irvine with a number of public officials. What was the gist of the message being sent?
Well, basically, it's something that you hear every once in a while here in Orange County. We are going to be hard on drugs because drugs are ravaging our communities. And of course, this is something that's been true in Orange County for decades. But like in the past 15 years, especially in the wealthier cities like on the coast or South OC, you've had a huge issue with opioids and fentanyl, of course, being the most potent generation of that. Yeah, it's really causing a lot of carnage. There's no better word to use.
So what have the authorities there in Orange County been talking about? Like, we're going to go after the dealers, or we've got to talk to the doctors because there are so many prescriptions of this stuff?
Well, as we know across the country with the scandals involving Purdue and the Sacklers, it's never initially about going to the big multi-billion dollar pharmaceuticals. You want to start with what a law enforcement thinks are easy pickings. So it's going to be the dealers on the ground or online. You're not going to criminalize the people who are overdosing on it, but you're trying to get that immediate problem right there. So that's what's happening here with Assembly Member Cadi Petri Norris. She represents Costa Mesa, some of the coastal communities. She's trying to push two assembly bills, one that would really crack down on online companies that make it easier for people to be able to sell drugs. And another assembly bill, it would raise the penalty for possession of fentanyl for sale, would go from between 2 to 4 years to a 3 to 9 year sentence.
Well, and you just touched on something, selling online. So talk more about the social media and the internet aspect of this.
You've had different law enforcement agencies try to go after social media companies for allegedly allowing sex trafficking to happen, for wildlife trafficking. And now a lot of law enforcement is going against them for the sale of drugs. So what Petri Norris's bill would say would be, you know, the government wants the social media companies to keep all these records of communications, which they already do, which I don't know. That one's going to be interesting. And that's the one that always usually gets struck down by the courts right now, because they say it's an abridgment of the rights that these social media companies have.
Well, it's also coming at a time, though, Gustavo, when, you know, the big push has been to reduce the number of people in jail, right? Reduce the number of people in prison, reduce sentences, particularly for drug crimes, right? So how do you jibe these things?
I mean, the assembly bill that Petri Norris pushed to stiffen penalties for possession of fentanyl, that went nowhere. And yes, in California, I mean, we've seen over the past decade, you want to reduce drug sentences. You want to free people whose lives have been railroaded because of the war on drugs in the 80s and 90s. But what's really interesting with fentanyl in Orange County, and especially the push coming from Orange County, Petri Norris is not some, you know, law enforcement worshiping Republican like in years past. She's a Democrat, and she's a pretty liberal Democrat. So the fact that she was at this press conference with Todd Spitzer, the district attorney of Orange County, who's very much throw them all in jail, that really represents a change of thought in Orange County, saying that we can't really have these liberal drug laws when they're destroying our communities. And there's kind of a classism there as well, because, you know, where was all this concern about drugs when it was mostly affecting working class communities in Los Angeles or even here in Orange County?
So what happens next with these bills? You think they make it through?
Well, one of them already has just been tabled. The other one, asking these social media companies to be more stringent, I think that one's going to go through because, again, you've seen a lot of this over the past decade. But that's the one. We all know how much power social media companies or just internet companies have. So they will fight against anything that makes them do more of a job than they already have to, even though, as we know, social media companies, by virtue of what they are, they have created all sorts of unintended consequences in our lives.
Gustavo Arellano, our regular here on GLA with today's KCRW Orange County Line. Gustavo, thanks.
Gracias.
Coming up, LA's glam rock days of the 80s is part backdrop for a new book that tackles coming of age, fitting in or not, and finding love. John Ray, who wrote Gone to the Wolves, is with us on the other side of this. Onward now with Greater LA from KCRW. I'm Steve Chiatakis. It's the late 1980s on the Sunset Strip. Hair metal is on its way out. The scene is changing, but no one really knows what's coming next. In step three, heavy metal-obsessed kids from Florida fleeing a life in a dead-end small town are looking for a better, more interesting future. Any future, really. Their quest will take them all over the world and back again. But first, L.A. will make its mark. Talking about the new book, Gone to the Wolves, by novelist John Ray. And John Ray is here to talk about that book. It's just out now. John, welcome to you.
Thanks, Steve. Great to be here.
This book is set in three locations, Florida, L.A., and Norway. which seems like a mighty trio right there. Did you always know that it was going to take place in these spots, or was there a place where the story started in your head and then you sort of just, you know, moved on from there, built it from there?
Well, the story really started with the idea of these three friends who are kind of oddballs and outsiders who find their way together to each other through their passionate love for all things metal. They're real metalheads, you know, they meet when they're teenagers. And once I realized I was going to follow these kids from their teens into their 20s, I kind of knew they were going to go from one metal scene to the next. And I just looked around and kind of picked the three most interesting and strangest metal scenes I could find.
Florida being the first one, this town, yeah. Where is it? Just outside of Tallahassee, right?
It's a town called Venice, which was actually the winter headquarters of Barnum and Bailey. So a very kind of freaky place to begin with, right on the Gulf Coast of Florida, a bit south of Tampa.
And they're trying to get out of there, right? Out of this dead end town so far. And I'm struck because I read this essay that you wrote for Esquire magazine called Heavy Metal Saved My Life.
Sure.
And I have to ask you, you know, how much of this is drawn from personal experience? Because that essay and your life comes out of South Buffalo, right? New York.
That's right. Yeah, Buffalo, New York, which when I was growing up in the 80s was dominated by metal. The sort of infamous death metal band Cannibal Corpse, which also features in the book a little bit, came out of Buffalo and then, in fact, moved down to Florida, where my novel begins, because Florida, Gulf Coast Florida, in the late 80s was a global mecca, believe it or not, for death metal bands.
Explain death metal for someone who doesn't understand what death metal is.
Well, one of the fascinating things about heavy metal as a genre is that starting in about the late 70s into the 80s, it started forking and dividing and kind of creating all of these competing sub-strains and subcultures, you know. And death metal is one of them. It began in the sort of the mid-80s, and it kind of took the sounds of bands like Motorhead and Black Sabbath and Priest and all these sort of classic bands of heavy metal in the 70s, and just made it a lot faster and a lot scarier and a lot more aggressive, and borrowed a lot from thrash metal, you know, also bands like Slayer and Metallica.
Tell us about these three characters in your book, Kip and Leslie Z and Kira.
Well, they are three very, very different people. When the book starts, they're all about 16, 17 years old, getting to the end of high school. And Kip is sort of our protagonist and the person from whose point of view we experience this crazy world that he moves through. And he shows up in the town of Venice, Florida, a bit of the way into his last year of high school, with no friends and not really even any family to speak of, and kind of a rough past, and knowing nothing about metal at all. But he kind of stumbles into this burgeoning, really vital and interesting underground metal scene that happens to be just about to explode in that moment of 1987 in Gulf Coast, Florida. The first friend Kip makes through the metal scene is quite a character. He's this kid called Leslie Z. No one quite knows what the Z stands for. And he's almost like a kind of scholar or philosopher of metal. He really geeks out on all the tiny details, and he knows the history of the music incredibly well. But he's also a real kind of oddball and an outcast in small town Florida, because he's a black kid adopted by these old Jewish parents. And he's also bisexual and very kind of flamboyant in his way. So it's kind of a miracle that he's even surviving there. But surprisingly, the metal scene is quite welcoming of him. And that's one of the first surprises Kip has when he starts going to these underground metal shows. The next friend he makes is just as important. It's this woman named Kira. She's a little bit older, about a year older than these two boys. And she's kind of the coolest in the group, you know, the most badass, and a little bit scary to them at first. And so these three friends, who all are passionately into metal in their own particular ways, find their way to each other and kind of all fall in love with each other, I guess you could say. And it's a friendship that lasts for years.
They go from the Florida panhandle all the way to LA's Sunset Strip in the 80s with the glam rock and the death metal and all of that. And some of their observations as new Angelinos are pretty striking. I want to read this one line that really got to me. Have you noticed, this is a conversation that they're having, have you noticed the light out here in this city, I mean, how it makes everything look artificial, like we're living inside a TV? And, you know, I assume you spent some time out here researching, because the sense of place is so strong in L.A., obviously. But that description of Los Angeles really hit me. Tell me a little bit about that.
Well, my family's from California. My dad grew up in Santa Paula, just north of L.A., and my grandfather was a judge of Ventura County. So even though I'm not from California, I always had a real connection to Southern California, spent a ton of time there. And then, you know, when I was in L.A., starting when I was about 15 or 16, I would go to all sorts of different music shows. So for me, it's a city that's just intimately connected with going to see live music, not just metal, of course, but all the crazy stuff that I saw back in the day, a lot of hardcore shows, Black Flag shows, but every kind of music, really, you name it.
There's one more L.A. description that I'd like for you to read. It's after they've been in town for about a year, and maybe some of the sheen has worn off, which can happen,
sure.
Obviously.
Yeah.
Kip is sitting in his car, and he watches a woman walk by. Can you read that for us?
The woman in the rear view was close enough now that he could read her expression, the sheepish smile of someone new to California, someone who'd only just realized that they'd escaped, however briefly, from the ruins of their past. Leslie had smiled like that once, and so had Kira. And so, presumably, had Kip himself. Maybe that was why the woman seemed familiar.
What is it about that, you know, that idea of L.A. as sort of escape hatch? How did you write that? Why did you write that?
Well, I think it's something that is a key part of the kind of California, maybe especially Southern California myth, Tons of people came to California thinking exactly that, I think, you know, that they would just become a different person simply by moving to the West Coast, you know. And I knew that you know, Kip and Kira and Leslie, as these young people who were coming from a dinky little town in Florida to Hollywood, you know, to kind of find all the kind of glamorous Sunset Strip that they'd been dreaming about, I knew they were going to have a profound period of disillusionment. Even though, of course, Los Angeles in the 80s was a fantastically fun and decadent and colorful place to be, still, you know, these are three kids who just find very quickly that being an adult is a lot harder than they anticipated.
Yeah. Isn't that what we all found out?
Pretty much.
You're going to be back on the Sunset Strip, right? Over at the Rainbow.
I will. I'm excited about it.
And that's coming up later this month. You know, the Rainbow is where much of your book takes place, the Sunset Strip, of course. Yeah. I wonder, we mentioned that Esquire essay that you did earlier, and how much all of this sort of is connected. What was that feeling that you had coming from South Buffalo? But then there you are partying on the Sunset Strip, and you're watching these hair bands or glam bands or death bands or whatever it may be.
It was a complicated feeling because I hated most of the hair metal bands that I was seeing at the time, but it was still fabulous in a way that, you know, coming from sort of gray, dreary Buffalo, New York, it was a completely different world. I don't think I was even able to kind of process it mentally for a long time. So I didn't really even know what I liked and what I hated about LA in that period. I mean, it certainly blew my mind and made an indelible impression on me, which is part of the reason I ended up writing this book so many decades later.
John Ray, the book is called Gone to the Wolves, which is out today. John, congratulations to you. Thanks for coming on.
Thanks so much, Steve. It's been a blast.
That's going to do it for us today. Tomorrow, the city of L.A. is commissioning a new memorial of the Chinese-American massacre in 1871, an attempt to finally remember the forgotten history of Los Angeles Street. We're going to take you there tomorrow on GLA. At the website, kcrw.com/GLA, tell us what's on your mind. Even share a story idea. And you can get the podcast, too. All at the website, kcrw.com/GLA. Juliana Mayo, Zoe Matthew, Michael Stark, Amy Ta, Carlos Ramirez, Christine Camito, and Christian Bordall all help put the show together. I'm Steve Chiatakis. Thanks for your time and attention, and of course that ear. Have a great day.